What is up, guys? Randy here with Quick Tips for Dads. Today, I am extremely excited to bring you my interview with Aaron Shields. Aaron is a former aerospace engineer, rocket scientist, if you will. He currently works in the world of software development, and more recently, he is making the move to coaching and life coaching and financial coaching. He is a Ramsey certified financial coach through Dave Ramsey and his team. And we get to talk about all things today pertaining to parenthood, finances, coaching, all of it. First, we discuss family finances and how to do those right. There's a lot we discuss that I found very impactful. Second, we talk about relationships and boundaries and how boundaries are extraordinarily important in family relationships. And lastly, we talk about coaching and how coaching helped Aaron become a better father and what it has taught him. I learned a lot from this conversation, and I sure hope you do too. Please enjoy my interview with Aaron Shields. All right, Aaron, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks, Randy. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you. I'm really excited. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time because you're somebody I admire, and you and your wife have been a couple that Natalie and I have looked up to as kind of a mentor couple.
So, oh, thanks, man.
We're excited. I'm excited to talk to you and chat with you here. So first, introduce yourself. How many kids you have? What do you do? How long you've been married? All that fun stuff. Anything you feel pertinent?
Yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah. Like I said, my name is Aaron Shields. I'm a coach. I help people, you know, figure out what they want, provide an environment for them to be able to, you know, get past whatever's in their way, strengthen relationships, and just live, you know, that life that they feel like they're meant to live. My wife, Katie, and I started this company officially not too long ago, just last year. But we've been working on it for quite a while, right? We've got six kids. They're all amazing, super high energy kids. And, yeah, we have a ton of fun, right? I've got background in lots of different things. It took me a while to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I have experience in aerospace engineering and rocket science. I have experience in enterprise marketing and software architecture. And yeah, now taking that crazy assortment of skills and applying it towards just helping people's lives get better.
It's awesome. There's no skill that's lost, no experience that's not used in the future. So you'll be able to take those experiences and turn them into some good stuff, I think.
Yeah, it's been great so far.
Awesome. Well, let's just dive right into it. Let's start family finances. Do you have a philosophy on family finances?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We spend quite a bit of time talking with folks about finances, because when you look at the spectrum of relationships that you're in, your relationship with money in general and with your family are some of the more influential ones, right? And so you kind of have to win in both of those areas in order to really feel like you're progressing, you're doing well. And so our philosophy as we approach, you know, people who, especially those who come to us with specific finance related questions, really it's like three things. It's got to be a team effort, right? You can't be in one of those scenarios where one person is in charge of all the finances. It's got to be a team effort. Mm-hmm. You also, number two, have to give yourself room to experiment, right? Most of the time when people fall down, it's in tracking and measuring, which I guess would be number three, right? Tracking and measuring is the key to change. So sticking to a budget, you know, reviewing it regularly, expecting that change, but giving yourself some room, right? It takes, on average, you can expect 3 months, sometimes more if you've got more complex situations. You know, if your income is irregular, or if, you know, there are other aspects that can kind of make that go even longer to figure out how to get in a rhythm. And spending time to refine that and looking at that as an experimentation time instead of like, we just can't do it. We just can't budget. Budget doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The point is that's going to be a living thing that you have to sort of nurture along the way, because it's not going to be right. You know, we don't expect our babies to just stand up and take off running.
Yeah.
Imagine if a baby just crashed a couple times and we're like, this walking thing, it's just not working for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not working. I give up. I quit. So just give yourself room to make mistakes, expect that that's going to happen. And then when it comes to that point, you can choose, you recognize you can choose between excusing, making excuses or blaming, you know, or getting upset about that, or looking at it as like, that didn't work. Let's try something else.
Yeah, I like that. And I've noticed, because we were pretty dialed in when I was working with our budget. We had we knew exactly how much we had. We really didn't need to take that much time every month and go over too much because we kind of had it set. But then things changed. And like, to your point, like, it's a very much a living thing. And I've noticed now, because we're living on some student loans for school, it like hurts my stomach a little bit to budget sometimes or to talk finances. Like, I don't know if you've experienced this, but like, I don't know what you would say to like those who just say like, it gives me a stomach ache just thinking.
No, totally. That's a very real thing. Like people don't usually make this correlation, but we say it all the time. So subconsciously it's definitely there. Stomach ache is super, super common, right? Because you're just depositing the anxiety that you're feeling somewhere in your body. The other really common one that I get with clients, especially related to finance, is in your lower back. So if you're feeling a lot of pain, you know, in your torso, in your midsection, right, or in your low back, it's probably just a signal that you've got some anxiety, some tension that's bottled up that you haven't been processing or taking care of. And it does build up. You know, our bodies are very responsive to what we're thinking about. So taking time to figure out where that's coming from and work through it instead of trying to ignore it is always a way better option.
So how would you work through it, I guess? So for anyone that's listening that's saying like, yeah, that's great, I need to work through it. How? Do you have any?
Yeah, totally. Well, the best advice I can give here is that you just have to get in and you need to start looking at your own thinking from an outside perspective. And the way that that works best for me and the way that I usually recommend to folks is to just start writing. Like physically writing, typing is okay, but I find that the actual act of writing, because it's so much more physically involving.
Like pen and paper writing.
Yeah, pen and paper, just get out there. This isn't something you're going to hang on to. So it doesn't have to be pretty or perfect or nice, but start expressing that anxiety, right? It's in you right now. You got to get it out so that you can look at it from the outside, right? This is the same reason they do biopsies. Right. If they're worried, if you got a tumor or something weird that's happening in your body, the doctor will go in, they'll take a piece of it out of you so they can see better what's going on, run tests on it and figure out what's going on with it. Right. You got to do that same thing with any particular spots or areas of anxiety in your life. You got to take it out so that you can look at it and examine it a little more clearly. Right. Doing that in your own head is going to be very, very limited in terms of, you know, how much insight you'll be able to get. So pen and paper, write it out. Sometimes it takes a while for stuff to get going, and don't worry about that. Just sit down, pen and paper. If you're feeling anxiety, you say, I'm feeling anxiety because. And at this point, you're just going to start writing whatever comes into your head. Doesn't have to be coherent, doesn't have to be anything, but the whole point is, you're looking for a way to get that emotion from where it is inside of you now, outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Once it's out there, then you can start doing some really cool stuff. You can start examining it a little more methodically, right? Taking a more objective approach to it, because you can start looking at what things, you know, there's going to be a lot in there that's just, you know, just garbage, just completely not true. And those things you'll be able to recognize and you can reject, right? Mm-hmm. And other things are going to be like the hardest ones are the ones that are, they have a kernel of truth in them. And then we just build a bunch of garbage around it, right? So if there's some skill that you're lacking, for example, then you might've translated that into, therefore I'm a horrible dad and I'm never going to be able to provide for my family. And my life's always going to be hard and everybody's so mean to me, mm-hmm. right? And so you gotta allow yourself some space between that thought and you and yourself so that you can start picking it apart and really figuring out, you know, what is it about this thing that's causing me to feel the way that I'm feeling. Once you know that, you'll know what to do. to resolve that, right? You can take steps to start, you know, reprogramming those thoughts and reintroducing things that are actually true instead of having this, you know, head trash blowing around in your head all the time.
Yeah, I like that. It's like we talked about the other day. It's like defragging your computer. Like it's going in and letting the cache and cookies get deleted and just delete any errors that have saved, whatever.
Yeah.
Start chiseling away at some of the issues, the core issues.
Right. Because when things start to slow down, it's like, oh, okay, it's time to defrag my computer. Right. Yeah. You just know that because you can observe that it's not going well. But then at the same time, how often do we, for example, know exactly what it is that we need to do? Right. We've already decided what the thing is that we need to accomplish, but we just can't bring ourselves to do it. Or it feels so slow, like we're just trudging through it. Right. And yet we don't pause and think, maybe my brain needs to be defragged.
Yeah.
Right? My coaching practice, we call this emotional hygiene. Right. It's really easy. My kids come in after playing in the mud and I'm like, okay, it's time to clean you up. Like how often do we do that with our own emotions? Like, I'm seeing a lot of negativity kind of oozing out of me and getting all over my family, my kids, my spouse, whatever. Let's take a minute and just clean that up. Right. I don't want to spread that, track it through the house.
I like that. You kind of leave it at the door. Like you can like mentally, metaphorically, whatever, take out the trash.
Yeah.
Like from your brain. I really like that. And that can apply to more than just finances. Like we're kind of talking about finances at first, but that can apply to anything I would imagine.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, cool. I really like that. Thank you. So many couples have had difficulties getting on the same page with finances. Have you had that experience with Katie, and how have you dealt with that? Or how would you recommend people work on that?
Oh, totally. It took us like 10 years to figure out how to get our finances to work. Like, I'm not exaggerating, at least 10 years of back and forth and figuring stuff out, because you come from very different backgrounds.
Yeah.
Right. At that point in time, when we were first married, Randy, luckiest decision I've ever made. I can't even believe how lucky I got, knowing how little that I knew about like human behavior and stuff, to find Katie and to actually have that work has been such an amazing thing. But at that point, we weren't very self-aware either, right? We weren't aware of what programming we were carrying, what lessons we had learned, what decisions we made about how the world worked. We were just sort of carrying all of that. And some of that we get from our parents, others we get from just experiences in general,
just living life.
But without figuring, like before we figured out where all that those thoughts were coming from, we had all sorts of trouble. Right. I'll give you a good example. One of the things that I struggled with was this belief that no matter how much we made, it was all going to be gone before the month was out. Therefore, if there was anything I wanted, then I should just buy it.
Get it quickly.
Because whether I bought it or not, I'd still be broke at the end of the month. Right? You could imagine some marital tension that may have caused. Because I just buy stuff.
Yeah, go buy a guitar, go buy a gun, go buy whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is, right? And that was really hard because, you know, when we would sit down and be like, well, we're broke again. Now there were things that we could point at. Well, you've got that stereo system over there or whatever it is, right?
There's
and then I was looking at the other side of things. You know, Katie does a lot of grocery shopping, and I'm thinking, why are we spending so much money on food?
I've had the same thought.
I'll tell you, Randy, having six kids and having those start to become teenagers and stuff has not helped the grocery situation. So we came from very different places, right? And getting on the same page, that's part of why you need to give yourself, you know, 3 months, maybe even more, to figure out how your budget is going to work, because you need time to discover what's actually important to you. And then I find it extraordinarily helpful to create an actual list of what do I value as a person? What does my spouse value? So have them create that list. And then you need, I think, a third list, which is as a family, as a unit, these are the things that we are going to value. Right. And a lot of times we never get all the way there and we just get stuck. Like my values are these and they're ranked in this order. My spouse's values are different, or they might even be the same, but in a different order.
Mm-hmm.
And having them be different inherently causes some friction.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the first things that you need to do as a couple, as a family unit, is decide what's going to be most important for that, for the family. Right. Which means that you might not always agree with it, but you understand and you've decided that it's important. And, you know, that helps ease some of that tension. Right.
Yeah.
And gives less room for things like resentment to build up.
That's good. Cause yeah, we've had different experiences with budget. And lately, for some reason, I used to be like king of the budget. I loved the budgeting. And now that we don't have the income, we're kind of living on the student loans. We have a set amount every month. We know exactly how much we have to live on. I hate budgeting. I hate, because maybe it's just that I don't get to create anymore. Like, I don't feel like I'm expanding. I don't know. But what we used to do is we'd go on a date for budget night. Like we'd go out to lunch and do our budget together. Like we'd set money aside. We'd go out to lunch and like make it an enjoyable experience instead of a, hey, we have to budget. This is gonna suck. Sure. I don't know if you guys have had any experiences like that or do anything like that when you come together every month, or is it just like a meeting? You're just like, oh, let's talk.
Yeah. It's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. Right now there's a lot in flux, right? We're doing a bunch of home improvement projects. We're getting this business off the ground. So we have a little micro budget meeting either every evening or every other evening. There's a lot. Oh, wow. Just because we just have to keep track of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as you approach more of a steady state, you know, way of living, then you might not need as many check-ins. But for us, that's super important just because we have to be able to manage any drift between what the plan is and what's actually happening really, really early. Got to just mm-hmm. stay on top of things. But yeah, it's really, really important to figure out what's going to work. And at first it's going to be very high touch. Like if you haven't budgeted before, you just need to be aware going into it that you're going to be spending a significant amount of time doing it. Especially you got to give yourself some room. You're going to have some discussions about money. You might mm-hmm. have fights or arguments about money as you work out what those values are going to be and what order they're going to happen in. So you got to just make room for that and make time to kind of work through that. And that's, I think it's good that we started talking about emotional hygiene, because so important to realize that the anger, frustration, criticism, whatever you're feeling coming up, you know, your spouse doesn't deserve that. Mm-hmm. As it comes up, like picture yourself just dirty, muddy, like go wash it off, go take care of it, and then come back. Emotionally neutral, you can keep working on the problem, right? Too often we, you know, we get all riled up and then our focus shifts from the problem to the person.
Yeah.
Right. And we end up damaging our relationship sometimes just because we have these emotions that have gotten out of control.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's because I've noticed something I was taught a long time ago was that if it's a money problem, it can be fixed. Like, period.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of other times where, you know, I hope it hasn't. I'm sure there's been times where my wife and I have said, hey, there's a money issue, and we got in a fight or argument or whatever. We've never really gotten in a drag out screaming match or anything. Sure. Thank heavens. But like, there's been some frustration and resentment because of those prior conditioning. She sees the world one way, I see the world another way. And that's what makes us a good working together, because we can see where the other can't.
Yep.
And I imagine that you feel that same way with Katie, that she can see things that you can't.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And it's my job to make sure that I'm in a place emotionally where I can accept, right, and examine mm-hmm. the things that she's seeing rather than rejecting. Because what happens is when we start to get emotionally charged, our walls go up.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we start to kind of turn inward, and then you're not open to anything like that, right? Or it feels like it could even come across differently. You know, Katie might be saying something like, maybe we shouldn't be spending so much money on I don't know, let's just make something up, widgets, right? Like, why do you keep buying widgets? Well, I might answer like, why do we spend $400 on supplements, you know, or whatever, right? That's not the problem. I'm trying to defend whatever my, I'm trying to protect my own hurt feelings, right? My own negative mm-hmm. feelings. So getting those out allows you to look together at the problem rather than being sort of at odds with each other.
Yeah. And it helps you kind of with the dissonance that you may feel, like with your own personal cognitive dissonance. You're like, well, I know she's right, but I don't want her to be right, or whatever it may be. It helps you kind of work through that dissonance. If you're that emotional hygiene, I really like that.
Yeah. It's a total game changer, right? If you can come to any conversation, not just as a couple, but even in your professional relationships, you know, if you're involved in any sports, you'd be amazed at how much better everything goes if you're coming from a place of emotional stability.
Yeah.
It's just amazing what happens.
That's true. And if you are emotionally stable, people will look to you also as a rock for them if they need help to work through their own issues and stuff. And you can increase your influence to help people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can only lift somebody as high as you are. What I like. So kind of recap family finances. I have loved this talking. You said a couple of principles within your philosophy is it's a team effort.
Yep.
It's going to take room to experiment, to figure out 3, maybe even more months to work out your budget. And I mean, it could wholesale change at any point in time. If you change jobs, change circumstances, whatever. And then track and measure what you're doing. Are those kind of the 3 guiding principles you would say for family finances?
Yep. Yep. And I think I might add one to kind of cover all of those, right? Which is like, spend time focus on why. Because like you're saying, Randy, there's going to be times in your life when it's not fun. And as much as you try to dress it up, it's still going to be work. And it's going to feel like work, right? It's not mm-hmm. going to be fun. And so there's a lot, you know, there's a lot about, you know, financial discipline and just discipline in general that isn't very pretty, right? It's not super fun. And there's going to be a lot of menial things that you have to do if you want that result. So my overarching or my crowning piece of advice on top of those 3 would be to focus on why, right? Why are you budgeting? What is life going to be like because you're doing this work, mm-hmm. right? Who is this for? How's this going to affect you as an individual in the future? It doesn't even have to be that far in the future, right? What's that going to mean for your family? What feelings are going to come from having the discipline to do the menial stuff? Now, if you can attach some meaning to the work, to the menial work, then it might still feel like work, right? But you're going to find more motivation to actually do it and keep it up and maintain it if your focus is on the why.
Yeah, I really like that. And the thought that just came to me is it's more than just a financial benefit. As you're showing your children how to be good stewards, you're teaching them things. You're teaching them, you know, if you want peace in your life in this dimension, this is one tool in your tool belt that I can give to you.
Yep. No, that's absolutely true, right? So you could make decisions to change that affect not just you and your spouse, but all of the people that you come into contact with.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's why you're going to track. That's why you're going to sit down and do the budget. That's why you're going to respond to changes. That's why you're going to catch yourself when you're getting emotionally yucky and go get cleaned up a little bit. Right. And again, you can write that out and then just tear it up when you're done. If you have a place where you can just go outside for a while, mm-hmm. sometimes it's nice to just be able to just, you know, dump all that outside and let the wind take it away. Just don't dump on other people.
Yeah.
Right. When we talk about venting too often, I think we'll call somebody up and all of this negative emotions and frustration and stuff, we're just going to dump it on them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the people who are best at accepting that are the ones that you don't want to give it to, right? They're people that you care about. A lot of times, you know, the reason that these people accept so much negativity and trash from people is because they're so easily empathetic, right? Like they feel those same things too. And yeah, you know, like imagine if you got dirty and you felt like the best way to get clean was to wipe yourself all over somebody else. Right? You're not, I mean, you might feel a little cleaner, but all you've really done is spread it.
Yeah.
Like this is a solo thing. You work through it and you get it figured out. And in extreme examples, like there are awesome professionals out there, therapists and counselors who can help you work through some of the, you know, some of the messier or meatier things that you might need to work out. But for daily regular maintenance, you know, writing some stuff down and then getting rid of it. Don't hang on to it, right? Go outside, talk to a tree, or just shout into the wind or whatever, and just let that go away. Just picture all of that just getting out of you, right? And that's gonna help a lot.
That's awesome. Mine's the steering wheel. Sometimes when I need to yell at something, steering wheel takes the brunt of it.
Yep.
So that's a great transition actually into our next little segment here about relationships and building your relationships with your kids and establishing boundaries. Mm-hmm. I think those two often people don't want to connect the two. They think boundaries is a really restrictive term, but in reality, boundaries really are what can make us free. And they can boundaries and not necessarily restrictive in restriction boundaries, but like they, I don't know how I want to say this, but boundaries really are the key to unlocking our full potential, is living within the bounds that we have set for ourselves or that have been set for us. And so when we establish relationships with people, boundaries are extraordinarily important. And with marriage, you know, in-laws and aunts and uncles and cousins and siblings, I imagine that gets pretty sticky sometimes. And I know you guys are pretty strict with your kids on certain things. Has there been issues with boundaries that you've dealt with? And you don't have to go into too deep of specifics.
Constantly, right?
And how have you worked through those?
Yeah. Like, anytime you set boundaries, those boundaries will almost immediately be tested, right? And it could be you. It could be you pushing your own boundaries. Like, I'm going to get up at 6:30 in the morning. And then you're like, well, do I really want to, though? And it becomes an integrity issue. And when I talk about integrity, maybe because of my engineering background, I maybe think about it in maybe in a slightly different way, right? Integrity is the ability to hold up under stress. Right. So imagine you ask me for a drink of water and I come and I just pour it all over your desk. Right. We have a boundary issue. If I can take that same thing and I can put it in a cup, I can provide some clear constraints for that. It's going to be way more beneficial. And too often our own boundaries, we sort of treat that way. Right. Like it's amazing to me how many people will be like, no, boundaries are bad. Like I need my kids to be able to do whatever and discover the world and figure things out for themselves. And then they get super upset if their food touches, right? Or something like that. So as humans, it's important to recognize that for us to be able to function, boundaries must exist, right? Your skin keeps your insides away from the outside, right? Even in your body, boundaries are super important. That's why blood vessels exist. That's why your digestive tract is sort of self-contained, right? You've got this network of things that go through you, and the interfacing points between your digestive system and the rest of your body are strictly defined. And when we have issues with that, when we have, you know, digestive or health issues or anything else, quite often what we're experiencing is boundary problems, right? Mm-hmm. And so we, both physically and emotionally, need these boundaries because things need space, well-defined spaces to exist if those things are going to be valuable, right? And maintain their value or their pureness, right? Think about if you have a container of salt and, you know, it's like 100% salt in there, But if you go, if it's, you spill it in the dirt and then you kind of sweep it back up and put it back in, again, you've got sort of a boundary issue, right? Because now it's salt and a bunch of other random stuff. And the, you know, and it becomes something much less desirable than it was, you know, just a few minutes before. So when it comes to boundaries with kids, I find the most important thing to do is to spend time deciding, again, like we talked about values, mm-hmm. what's important to you and how important are the boundaries that I've set? Because you can be too strict. And the way that you can tell that you're being too strict is that you're exhausted all the time and everybody's unhappy. Enforcing boundaries requires energy. And so you have to, we have this phrase, pick your battles, mm-hmm. right? Really what you're saying is, as you're setting up these boundaries, you need to decide which, you know, which of these are, you know, are more firm relative to the others so that you can enforce them appropriately. Mm-hmm. Right. You might have a bedtime, right? Bedtime's at 7:30 or bedtime's at 8 o'clock or whatever bedtime is.
Yeah.
But if it's New Year's or if the grandparents come over and it's a little bit late, or like there are going to be situations when you'll want to flex those boundaries, mm-hmm. right? Whereas a firmer boundary might be, we don't play in the road ever.
Right.
Right. Or, you know, we don't run off in public for any reason. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things like that that are going to be, you know, more strongly enforced.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I think we failed at initially as parents was helping our children understand the relative importance of boundaries, right? Sometimes we end up with so many rules that you feel like either everything's equally important, which means nothing is,
yeah,
or there's just no way, no space to actually be successful or creative or happy in because we've divided it up too much.
Yeah.
Right. And that, so that's going to be a learning process. You're going to have to work through that and decide where those are going to be. You'll have to reevaluate them very regularly, especially as kids start to grow, so that A, you both don't lose your mind, yeah. and B, so that the kids learn themselves how to set up boundaries. Because really, what we want to do is teach them how to be productive, successful, contributing members of society, right? And as adults, they're going to need to know how to set boundaries, how to assign relative importance to those boundaries, and to be able to know, kind of get an intuitive sense of which boundaries can be flexible and which ones cannot.
Yeah. And kind of understand like the situation in each and how, I mean, it's like the law, for example.
Yep.
Negligence per se means you broke a law that you were negligent, like on purpose, even despite of the statute, right? And one of the examples we were given was, you are breaking the law if you go too far under the speed limit, right? But it's a situational thing. If it's icy on the road and it's snowing, obviously you're not going to go 80 miles an hour on the freeway. You might need to go 45 to be safe. And so you understand and help teach your kids that there are times and places where we will adjust the boundaries as necessary to ensure safety, fun, whatever it may be.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only way to do that in a way that's wise is to focus on the principles mm-hmm. behind the rules rather than the rules themselves. And you can start doing this from very early age, right? Just help instill the actual principle so that when you talk about the boundary, it's in the context of the principle.
Mm, I like that. Kind of under the umbrella of the principle is all the rules. And
yeah. And like I said, really early, like I still remember when a couple of our younger kids loved to just run out in the street, especially chasing balls and stuff like that.
Right.
I remember I was kind of losing my mind because we had a couple of near misses, right? One time our fourth child was riding his bike down the driveway, you know, not a super steep driveway, but for a kid that age, mm-hmm. he was probably three or four. And right into the road, and car slams on the brakes, and he very, very nearly gets just taken out. Mm. So I took him, and rather than, like, thankfully, I was in a place emotionally where I didn't freak out.
Yeah.
But I ran and I got him, and we sat together on the sidewalk and waved at the cars as they came past. And we talked about how you might not know when those cars are coming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to stay out of the road all the time. And if you're with a grown-up, then we can help you see farther because we're bigger, we're taller, we can see more of the cars coming. We'll help you. But if you're by yourself, it's best to just stay out of the road entirely. Right? Now, that doesn't mean we didn't have infractions after that.
Yeah.
But then it became a reminder of the principle rather than an enforcement of the rule.
Gotcha. Because it seems enforcement of the rule without understanding of the underlying principles can breed resentment pretty quickly.
Yep. Or it will make, or your kids will start to feel like they're broken.
Yeah.
Right. Because they, especially if they know the rule and they can't keep it.
Yeah.
Right. We want to make sure that we're enforcing the principles, and you'll still have consequences. You'll still have, you know, your job to do, you know, choosing consequences that fit with whatever the infraction of rule is. But if you can spend time first, you know, validating them as a human being and making sure they understand that, you know, it's not, they're not broken because they did this, but there's a principle and some training that needs to be applied at this point.
Yeah.
Way, way, way more productive.
I really like that, because that's something that my parents are pretty good at that. I mean, there were times I got in a lot of trouble for dumb things growing up, you know, I'm sure we all did. But when you're not teaching the principle, it almost feels like you can do nothing right as a kid.
Right.
And I imagine that's super detrimental to the development of a child.
Oh, absolutely. Like, especially if you think about the fact that most of the decisions, most of our programming as adults comes from decisions we make between ages 2 and 10.
Hmm.
So think about that, what that means in the context of how much we know about the world at that point. And if you hear your kid saying, "Oh, I just can't do anything right," or "Oh, I'm so stupid," or something like that, like, that's something that you really want to take seriously, because that decision might facet and result in some programming in their heads that takes years to dig out again.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, here's a great example. All my kids are crazy high energy. Most of them have ADHD. So our house is very chaotic at times. And so the other day I walked out, I can hear when it's getting out of hand, right? There's definitely some cues. So I walk out and all I say is, "What is going on?" And at that point, not before, hilariously, not before, like, up to that point, none of the kids thought, I wonder if this is a great idea. They're throwing stuff around in the house. And we have a rule about throwing stuff in our house. And our oldest son, now 13, recently broke a picture frame because he was throwing stuff in the house. And so his consequence was to replace it. He had to pay to replace the picture frame, which for him was a bunch of money.
Right.
And yet still, here he is chucking stuff. And I walk out, realization dawns on his face. And he immediately just bursts into tears. And what's happening in his head, because I talked to him afterwards, was he realized that he was right in the middle of doing something he knew was a terrible idea. And he didn't even realize it until I came out. And so, again, luckily, I was in a place emotionally where I was able to handle this. So we went to the other room. And I got to tell him, and my message was basically, you are a good kid. And you know that this stuff you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to throw stuff in the house. But there will be times when you get carried away and it happens. And I'm going to help you figure out how to make sure that when you're in that situation, you can still stop. You still have a choice.
Yeah.
Right. You can choose at this point to go back. It's not like I broke the rules, therefore I might as well just make the most out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that ended up being a really productive conversation, because he was feeling like, "Oh, I'm so stupid. I'm such a failure. I can't do anything right."
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I knew, here I was in the middle of doing this thing that I totally knew was wrong, and kind of got caught red-handed.
Yeah.
Right. And it turned into a situation where, look, sometimes that's going to happen. Right? You're going to get off track, or you're going to get distracted, and you're going to make decisions that you know are stupid. So there's a realization that's going to happen at some point. And we're going to try and get that realization happen as early as possible so that you can make the choice to make a change, to stop, to divert, to do some other things. Super helpful conversation compared to, like, you know, whatever I've done and I just flown off the handle.
Right. And it seems more changing our reference of mind is not disciplining so much as teaching and helping them grow. Like I look at it as like you're teaching someone to ice skate or to ski, and you're not going to get super mad at them if they fall down because you've told them a million times how to do it properly.
Yeah.
They're building the muscle memory, the mental muscle memory to do that, to remember that and to work on that. So it's working through those teaching moments instead of just disciplining for the sake of disciplining.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. One, if you think about discipline as a concept, it's not really something you can enforce on someone. I think that's a bit of a misnomer, right? Because discipline just means making a conscious decision to go against whatever your natural tendencies are. That's what it is. So as we come in from an external source, you know, I'm not saying like we have to intervene because no one is born with discipline, right? It's something that you have to be taught. But if you're doing it in a way that takes away their ability to choose and decide, then it's not really training discipline. It's just, you know, it's just forcing them into a pattern of behavior that you deem acceptable. So mm-hmm. Not the same thing.
Interesting. I like that. That's awesome. Moving on here, we've talked a lot about so many good things. So let's jump into coaching now and your transition from kind of corporate life into, you're still working.
Yeah.
In your job, in your corporate job, whatever you want to call it. And you told me that one of the reasons you got into coaching is that you realized you loved helping people and you loved working with people. Can you talk about what drives you to help people and why you love people so much and how helping people has changed your perspective?
Oh, totally. Right. So just a little more background, you know, as I was transitioning, when I was little, I wanted to be a rocket scientist. It's just ever since I was a puppy. So I went through school and I got the education and I landed the job and I was working what I thought was my dream job at the time. And, you know, kind of what led my transition away from that and into the enterprise software space was actually my desire to work with people and make improvements with a team. And then in enterprise software, most of my focus was on helping these companies designing software to help companies better understand the people that they were working with, right? Their customer, and being able to communicate with them in a way that was not disjointed, you know, across these different devices or across different things. So most of what I was working with, even from that perspective, was to help these big corporations work better with people. And so at some point, the light bulb just went on and said, oh, maybe what I really care about is not engineering nor software. You know, it's none of these things. It's actually people. And my wife and I had been informally coaching. My wife is you know, sort of the family therapist. Everybody comes in, and when they have problems and stuff, she helps them work through them. So we've been coaching people informally for quite a while. And I guess we just realized kind of all at once that all of the things that we cared the most about, you know, being together, we don't get tired of each other. So we wanted to do something together where the work week was us together doing something amazing. And then we also wanted it to, you know, have an impact. And what better impact can you have than helping someone, you know, creating an environment where someone can come in, talk about their dreams and start just guiding them, focus those dreams down into actual actionable steps. So that, and then walking with them as they run into issues, we help them take those issues apart. We just help them grow to whatever level they feel like they're meant to be at. So, so rewarding. And the neatest thing about coaching for me is that I feel like every time I'm guiding someone to, you know, discover some new truth about themselves or to, you know, inject some hope to say, you know, I totally believe in you. You can do this. You've got this. Mm-hmm. And to help them build a little bit more grit to get through those menial things we talked about earlier, there's no better feeling in the whole world than that, right? And I can't imagine a better way to spend time than just helping fellow human beings figure stuff like this out.
That's awesome. And people need that. People need somebody to help them work out what they don't understand. I know I've in the past needed counseling and I've talked to you about a lot of things. And it's just so important. I'm so grateful there are people that just love people so much. And I know that's going to bless so many lives. I'm so pumped for you guys to really just.
Oh, thanks, man.
To hit it. Like, I think you're going to bless a lot of lives with it. As you've learned how to coach and learned about, you know, it's kind of the life coach, because there are a lot of different types of coaches, athletic coach, you know, finance coach, whatever. How has coaching changed the way that you parent? Has it affected it? Has it changed it? Has it made you see things differently?
Oh, absolutely. Right. And I love that you bring up that we need coaches in so many different areas of our lives, right? Because regardless of whether it's athletics or academics, mm-hmm. or, you know, personal development or professional development, whatever walk of life you're talking about, the benefit of a coach is obvious. And it is that you need someone whose perspective is outside yourself to be able to point to things that might be potentially holding you back, or to suggest different ways of doing things to help you accelerate and improve as an individual, right? And so the obvious parallel is in athletics, right? There are no world-class athletes, but don't employ coaches.
It's true.
Right? And it's not because they don't know what they're doing, right? A lot of times people say, oh, I don't want to go to counseling because I think I can manage it on myself, my own, you know, or I don't think I need a coach. You know, I'm sort of a DIY type person. Well, let me tell you, if you DIY yourself, you're going to have very, very limited results, because the one thing you can never get back is time. So you might be able to read a bunch of books and implement some stuff, right? Take some information that you've learned and then apply that information in a way that makes your life better. But you're always fighting the clock. Imagine how much better off you'll be if you made an investment in someone who could watch what you were doing and help you do it in half the time, mm-hmm. right? Or a quarter of the time. And that's really been one of my favorite things about coaching in general. Like, my wife and I, obviously we have coaches that are coaching us as well. And part of the reason we make that big investment in the coaching is because we don't feel like we've got our entire lives to figure this out, right? I'd rather develop proficiency very quickly, mm-hmm. so that I'm better able to help others now, not in 15 years after I've read enough books and figured it out.
Right. Yeah, I like that. And so, like, as a parent, you're showing your kids by example how to how to make the most of your time, maybe is a better way to say it, and how to, I mean, honestly, show them a little bit of humility. Because I know a lot of people that are like, oh, I can't do it. I've got to do it myself. Or, I mean, for example, I remember somebody telling me, this was years ago, I was learning how to play guitar, and he decided to learn how to play guitar too. My friend did. And he said, Eddie Van Halen didn't take lessons or something. He just plays by feeling. That's how I'm going to play. But then I started taking lessons, and my trajectory went from, you know, a nice line to like a exponential growth, almost, like, compared to what my buddy ended up doing. And that's really what coaching can do, it seems like, is it can help you not just play life by feeling, but get an outside perspective and make the most of the time that you have. You think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny that you bring up the guitar thing specifically, because yeah, you can, like I said, you can absolutely, there are a handful of people in this world, we call them prodigies for a reason,
yeah,
that can take information from the world around them and convert that into, you know, incredible skill. And the reason that these people are famous is because it's very rare to do this, right? And we all like to think that we're the exception. But even these people, you know, when you think about a talent scout for athletics, right? You're looking for raw talent. You're looking for people that, you know, that have something special. But it's not like, I don't think you'd ever go and say, hey, you've got a lot of potential. Would you mind working that out on your own for a while and then coming back and we'll see what we can do?
Yeah, right? let me teach you how to get
go
there.
Off by yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Very, very rarely is a situation where that's going to work best. And I would actually argue that with training, even those prodigies can go from, you know, whatever high level they've been able to achieve, even more, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you end up with these, you know, these children that can play Bach on the piano and stuff like that, right? You think they did that on their own just because their parents gave them a piano and put them in a room? No, it's all about, you know, I remember when you talk about all money problems could be solved, right? Mm-hmm. The truth is that most problems in your life can be resolved, and anything that you lose can generally come back, especially financially.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like you could be all over the spectrum. The only thing you really can't get back is your own time. And I feel like we as individuals, especially when we're younger, just don't place enough value on what our time is worth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The other thing we do is we keep thinking that investing outside of ourselves is going to be the best way to get an ROI, right? If I just figure out what stocks to pick, mm-hmm. or, you know, if I just get enough rental properties or whatever it is, the truth is that the single best investment you can make is in yourself, because it's the only area where you have 100% control over that ROI.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty powerful place to be spending resources, for sure.
Yeah. And I guess I just had a thought that I thought about asking you is, I don't know how much your kids, if at all, use social media. I know I use it more than I would like to, and I'm sure you have in the past used it more than you would like. And how do you think social media plays into this working on yourself thing and you can't get back time? Because what ends up happening is we'll think, I'll just be on YouTube for this one video that I want to go see something specific. And then an hour later, you know, and 20 videos later, we're like, well, crap, I didn't do what I had intended to do.
Right. You're like, what just happened?
And then you feel bad you can't get that time back. So I guess two parts. One, do you think social media has affected the way we grow? And two, do you think social media can be harnessed for good?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yes to both, right? It absolutely affects the way that we grow. And it can be used for good. Like we still use social media to reach out to people, to keep up on stuff, to look at relationships that maybe we'd otherwise just not even have access to. You know, I've got friends now internationally that are easier to communicate now through social media and other means than they've ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
Big, there's a big caveat here, right? Because you have to ask yourself, you know, why are these services being offered for free?
Mm.
And the thing, the currency that you are paying with social media is the amount of time you spend there, right? Your attention and the time that you're giving is literally the currency that keeps those social media companies afloat.
That's true.
We talk about, like, most people know that Facebook is driven and operated on advertising revenue. That's why every third thing you scroll through is an ad, right? Or mm-hmm. or a clever post from some influencer who's actually trying to get you to buy something.
Right.
But the attention that you give to these things is so valuable that massive, massive companies have been stood up with the goal of capitalizing on as much of that attention as possible. So, like, that's the first thing that I would say, right? Just think about the fact that they value your time so much that they'll give you a bunch of value for free, you know, like maps, you know, social interactions. You can set up groups in there. You can chat in there. You can now even make, like, almost make phone calls in there.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the metaverse is coming.
Right. Why would they do all this for free? Because they value your time more than all of those things that they're giving you.
Interesting.
right? And if we're not valuing that, then there's a chance that we could get taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
And these, like I said, these programs are built, and it's not, I don't really buy into the whole social media is evil thing. They have a very specific goal, right? And that goal is based on revenue, and the revenue is driven by the amount of time people spend interacting with the applications or services. It's a very, very clear cut equation. And a lot of people argue, well, like that's why they spend time doing, you know, doing brain hacking and getting people addicted. And that all of that's, you know, that may be valid, but you have to understand, like, they're just pursuing goals that are based on values that they hold. And you have to decide as an individual and as a family if their values align with yours, right? If you're okay trading your time and attention, and, you know, a lot of times we end up, you know, there's a big shift right now towards external validation is one of the biggest problems that we're facing right now.
Mm-hmm.
As you're setting goals as a dad, quite often it's most of the things that you think look like, you know, if you were to say, what does an ideal dad look like? Almost all everything that you would write would be an external form of validation, right? Social media hasn't made that any easier because it's, you know, trying to teach us that that's exactly how you should measure everything is by what other people think of that, or what other people say, or how people react to you. That's where your value is. So we have to be really careful there. I would say careful introspection of what is important to you and why you're doing the things you're doing is a critical first step before you even step into those social media spaces, to make sure that you're using them in a way that benefits you enough to justify the benefit that the companies themselves are getting.
Yeah, I like that. That's really good, because I know I've lost a lot of time to social media and probably a lot of attention and like mental capacity.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, in my head going all crazy.
And yeah. Yeah. And I would even expand that to mainstream media as well. Like any media outlet, you have to understand the way that they get attention is through strong emotions. And for some reason, because of the way that we're wired to try and survive. So strong negative emotions are the single most effective tool in capturing attention.
Hmm.
So most of what you hear and see in media generically is going to play towards those negative emotions, because they are the strongest motivator for action in human beings, right? So I think if you were to track your overall mental health and then correlate with that with the amount of time you spend on social media, you'd see a very clear trend. But it could also be just a regular news feed.
That's true.
The point is that, like, journalism now has devolved into to the point where if you don't have something that's like super emotionally stirring, then there's a decent chance that you won't get any readership, right? I think we, as a society, we've sort of chosen into this fear-based or emotion-based information distribution model. And doing that has some consequences. You can't be in there all the time and expect that you'll be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've seen with certain parents, grandparents that watch a lot of news on either side of the aisle. Like, I'm not picking a side right now because it doesn't matter. Both sides are doing a lot of fear things and a lot of negative emotion things, like you were saying. But we notice the feeling changes in us and in our baby too, in Liam. Like, we'll be somewhere and they'll have the news station on and they're just, you know, bashing the other side, whatever side it is.
Yeah.
And he acts up every time, almost without fail. He gets upset. You can tell he's irritated, and maybe it's that we're not paying enough attention to him, but, like, I don't know. He kind of has this, he can sense the feeling and the spirit that's in the room.
Yeah.
He doesn't like it.
Yeah. Energy is a very real thing, right?
Yeah.
And if you have strong negative energy kind of bouncing around, it's going to affect people.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we've done as a family to try and curb that's why we don't spend a lot of time watching movies. Our kids haven't watched very many movies. We do read a lot of books. We love classic literature. We love historical, like nonfiction, historical fiction, lots of different kinds of things. But the whole point is to teach along the way, right? And to be careful of the amount of time we spend in those emotional places. There are definitely place for emotions like fear, right? Because without fear, you end up with people doing really dumb things and getting hurt or killed, right? So the emotion itself is not necessarily a bad thing, but when it's misapplied, so now you're afraid to go to the grocery store, you're afraid to do this, you're afraid to do whatever, like that's very unhealthy, right? Mm-hmm. So being more cognizant of that actually improves your parenting quite a bit as well, because when it's time to be serious at that point, when it's time to say like, look, that was a scary thing that just happened, you know, those emotions aren't going away, but because you're actively managing those and intentionally managing those, when it is time to use them, they're much more effective.
Yeah, that's awesome. We are running low on time. So just do one more question here for you. The last question I ask everybody on anyone I interview is, you're looking back at the end of your life. You're 90, 100, whatever years old. You're on your deathbed. You're looking back and you've lived your whole life. What would being a successful dad look like to you at the end of your life?
Oh, what a good question. Especially since we were talking about external validation, because this has shifted for me a lot, just even over the last, 12 to 18 months. Because I realized that, had you asked me that question even a couple of years ago, I probably would have said, I'm a successful dad because my children are all successful. They're making good choices in life. They found good spouses. Their families are super tight, and it's all about, I'm a good dad if all of these other people make the choices that I hope that they make. Mm-hmm. Right. And certainly there's still a desire for that to happen. Yeah. But I feel like it's really important to separate the impact of your life or your choices from, what success looks like to you. Because if you define success in terms of other people's choices, you're basically saying, I'll let you decide whether I was successful. That's a dangerous place to be, because they may or may not choose the way that you want them to choose, but your control is dissipated as you move outward. So today, what is being a successful dad look like to me? It's all about what I give, right? So have I given my kids all of my heart? When they need me, do I choose to give my attention to them, right? Have I done everything I can think of to communicate my affection for them? Have I done my best to teach the principles that I know, right? Focusing on the things that I know that I can do, that I have complete control over. Like that's what's going to make me and you and everybody else way more successful, is defining that in the context of what we're able to do. And so that would be my answer, right? If at the end of my life, I've given everything I have to helping improve my children's lives, to helping improve my community, if there's a legacy that I can provide to them because of the things that I have done, then I'm going to feel successful.
Love that. That's so good. Because everyone has their own flavor of answers. And it's just so interesting hearing all these different dads. And I've interviewed one or two grandpas, just one grandpa so far. And just the way that they see life. I love that you control what you can control. And that's all you can do.
Yep.
So, well, awesome. Thank you so much for spending this last hour with me, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
I can't believe it flew by so quickly. So. Where can people find you if they want to try and connect with you, or if they decide like, hey, I want to look into him as a coach or as a financial coach or anything? Where can they find you?
Yeah, the best way to find me is just via the web, mountainsidementoring.com. And you can book consultations right there. We can get to know you a little better. And it's really simple process, right? It's really three steps. We sit down together and just learn about you. What are your goals? What are your dreams? What do you really want to accomplish? What's getting in the way? We'll talk a lot about that. Second step is we come up with customized plans and questions that help really get from what you're thinking now to where you could be. And then we just handhold you along the way, right? We execute on that plan together, make adjustments as things come up. And it's a really nice, like just really simple experience. So that's what I encourage you to do. Just go to the website, book an appointment, and we'll talk, then we'll get started with it just right from there.
Awesome. We'll put that in the show notes and so people can find it easier. So, all right. Thanks again, Aaron. We will talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you again for listening. This is Quick Tips for Dads with Randy Everett. If you found value in this conversation, please like, subscribe, share this to anyone you think it might add value to. If you want to get in touch with Aaron for coaching or anything that if you think he could be a value to your life, I will link his website in the show notes below. And again, I thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you all next time. Peace.